Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And Leo. And tonight we have an interview with two poets, actually, published in Totally Press. And they're going to be on a little later.
And the book editor.
Yeah.
She's a poet as well as the editor of the chapbook. She has pretty good books on poetry, a nice little collection of different poets. They get together and work together.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun with them. It was kind of a different kind of night. You know? Interesting?
Yep.
And we were, and you'll get that tonight when we do more, when we do that. excuse me. I'm still struggling with a cold there, but we're going to go to... a few things. $23 billion bonus plot. What do you think of that?
Pot. Bankers pay and...
Yeah, so let's go into that. $23 billion.
J.P. Morgan staff in line for... Well, what could happen here? Goldman Sachs set to announce record $23 billion bonus pot. Bankers pay and bonuses set to spark... more anger this week after it was revealed that the U.S. investment bank Goldman Sachs is set to pay out a record $23 billion to its employees. Bumper third quarter profits from the Wall Street giant last week should confirm that the average Goldman employee, including the 5,500 that work at its plush European headquarters in Fleet Street, is, of course, to pocket around £500,000 for this year.
I don't understand this really quite well. Okay, J.P. Morgan stuff. Oh, see, we're getting this as a...
Go again. Try one more time.
No, I don't think so, because there's a Trojan in there. Mm. So...
they don't want you to read it.
Probably. If he's got one in there.
Obama quietly deploying 13,000 more U.S. troops to Afghanistan. Move is separate from the NATO Commissioner General Stanley McChrystal's request to increase troop levels. President Barack Obama is quietly deploying an extra 13,000 troops to Afghanistan, an unannounced move that is separate from a request by the U.S. commander in the country for even more reinforcements. The extra 13,000 is part of a gradual shift in priorities since Obama became president away from Iraq to Afghanistan. The White House and the Pentagon both announced earlier this year that the number of U.S. troops in Afghanistan was to be raised by 21,000, bringing the total at present to 62,000 with the aim of 68,000 by the end of the year. But the Washington Post, based on conversation with Pentagon officials, said that on top of those, an extra 13,000 enablers are also being deployed. They are mainly engineers, medical staff, intelligence officers, and military police. Almost about 3,000 of them are specialists in explosives being sent to combat the growing fatality rate from roadside bombs. The deployment of such non-combat troops is in line with the professed aim of the U.S. Commander, General Stanley McChrystal, to try to win the hearts and minds of the Afghan population. Let's see. The U.S. spokesman in Iraq, Brigadier General Stephen Lanza, said yesterday that the number of U.S. troops in Iraq will be down to 120,000 by the end of the month, down 23,000 since January, but any further large-scale reductions will have to wait until after Iraqi elections next January. So Iraq, they have fewer troops, but they're putting more into Afghanistan. So let's go back. We'll just text that out and go to the next one. Let's see. The EU turns its hideous strength. I don't know who is Vaclav Klaus.
No,
I don't know what that is. So that's not anything that I know anything about. Does this matter? But what if everything we think we know about fighting influenza is wrong? What if flu vaccines do not protect people from dying, particularly the elderly, who account for 90% of the deaths from seasonal flu? And what if the expensive antiviral drugs that the government has stockpiled over the past few years also have little? What if the expensive antiviral drugs that the government has stockpiled over the last few years have little, if any, power to reduce the number of people who die or are hospitalized? The U.S. government, with supportive leaders in the public health and medical communities, has put its faith in the power of vaccines and antiviral drugs to limit the spread and the lethality of swine flu. Other plans to contain the pandemic seem anemic by comparison. Yet some top flu researchers are deeply skeptical of both flu vaccines and antivirals. Like the engineers who warned for years about the levees of New Orleans, these experts caution that our defenses may be flawed and quite possibly useless against a truly lethal flu. And that, unless we are willing to ask fundamental questions about the science behind flu vaccines and antiviral drugs, we could find ourselves in a bad epidemic, as helpless as the citizens of New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. Let me just see. I'll read a little more of that, see what it says. This was from the Atlantic. Okay. Let's see. Vaccination is central to the government's plan for preventing deaths from swine flu. The CDC has recommended that some 159 million adults and children receive either a swine flu shot or a dose of MedImmune's nasal vaccine this year. Shots are offered in the doctor's offices, hospitals, airports, pharmacies, schools, polling places, shopping malls, big box stores like Walmart. In August, New York State required all healthcare workers to get both seasonal and swine flu shots. To further protect the populace, the federal government has spent upwards of $3 billion stockpiling millions of doses of antiviral drugs like Tamiflu, which are being used both to prevent swine flu and to treat those who fall ill. Let's see. The term influenza, which dates back to the Middle Ages, is taken from the Italian word for occult or astral influence. Then, as now, flu seemed to appear out of nowhere each winter, debilitating or killing large numbers of people, only to vanish in the spring. Today's season of flu is estimated to kill about 36,000 people in the United States and 500,000 people worldwide. Yet the flu, in many important respects, remains mysterious. Determining how many deaths it really causes or even who has it is no simple matter. We think we have the flu anytime we fall ill with an ailment that brings on headaches, malaise, fever, coughing, sneezing, and that achy feeling as if we were sleeping on a bed of rocks. But researchers have found that at most half, and perhaps as few as 7 or 8% of such cases are actually caused by influenza virus in any given year. More than 200 known viruses and other pathogens can cause the suite of symptoms known as influenza-like illness, respiratory syncytial virus, Boca virus, coronavirus, and rhinovirus. They're just a few of the bugs that can make a person feel rotten. And depending on the season, in up to two-thirds of the cases of flu-like illnesses, no cause at all can be found. Nobody knows precisely why we are much more likely to catch the flu in the winter months than at any other time of the year. Perhaps it's because flu viruses flourish in cool temperatures and are killed by exposure to sunlight. Or maybe it's because in winter people spend more time indoors, where a sneeze or a cough can more easily spread a virus to others. What is certain is that influenza virus mutate with amazing speed. So each flu season sees the slightly different genetic versions of the viruses that infected people the year before. Every year, the World Health Organization and Center for Disease Control and Prevention collect data from 94 nations on the viruses that circulated the previous year and then make an educated guess about which viruses are likely to circulate in the coming fall. Based on that information, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration issued orders to manufacture in February for a vaccine that includes the three most likely strains. Every once in a while, however, a very different bug pops up and infects far more people than the normal seasonal flu variants do. It is these novel viruses that are responsible for pandemics defined by the World Health Organization as events that occur when a new influenza appears against which the human population has no immunity and which can sweep around the world in a very short time. The worst flu pandemic in recorded history was the Spanish flu of 1918 at the end of World War I. A third of the world's population was infected with at least 40 million and perhaps as many as 100 million people dying, more than were killed in the World Wars I and II combined. Some scholars suggest that one reason World War I ended was that so many soldiers were sick or dying from the flu. Since then, two other flu pandemics have occurred, 1957 and 1968, neither of which was particularly lethal. In August, the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology projected that this fall and winter, the swine flu, H1N1, could infect anywhere between one-third and one-half of the U.S. population and kill as many as 90,000 Americans, 2.5 times the number killed in a typical flu season. But precisely how deadly or even how infectious this year's pandemic will turn out to be won't be known until it's over. Most reports coming from the Southern Hemisphere in late August suggested that the swine flu is highly infectious but not particularly lethal. For example, Australian officials have estimated they would finish winter with under 1,000 swine flu deaths, fewer than the usual 1,500 to 3,000 from seasonal flu. Among those who have died in the U.S., about 70% were already suffering from congenital conditions like cerebral palsy or underlying illnesses such as cancer, asthma, or AIDS, which makes people much more vulnerable. This article goes on and tells many, many things. Quite a long article. I read you the most important.
Not too.
Yes, it is. No. It keeps going.
Okay. Well, she didn't. Did you read the 90,000 people?
Yeah, I've read most of this article.
Okay.
And let me just tell people where they can get it if they want to find out more information on it.
Okay.
It's from the Atlantic.
Right, which is put in Atlantic.
Must be a magazine.
Yeah, I don't think it's Atlantic.
Monthly, and it's not. And this article is by Shannon Brownlee and Jean Lenzer.
That just says Atlantic. .com.
Might be an online, or it could be.
Actually, if you want an interesting place to go to davidicke.com, check out some of these things. He's a great source for lots of stuff. Okay, Israel to raise 150,000 Palestinian homes. Isn't that nice of them? Second. Let's see. I can't find it. So that's good. Probably today's news that might have been the other day. Can't find it.
It was from Press TV. We don't really have time to go and look for it. So.
No. But it just says Israel has announced plans to demolish 150 Palestinian homes the most Arab East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, in a move that could displace more than 1,000 Palestinians. Pretty sick.
The Czech president won't sign the Lisbon Treaty. Let's go to that.
Okay.
But the Irish finally signed it. That's what John was talking about.
John was saying. What we got here. Okay. The president of the Czech Republic has no intention of signing the Lisbon Treaty, a move that might allow David Cameron time to hold a British referendum on Europe. President Klaus, the fiercely Eurosceptic Czech leader, is the last obstacle for the agreement after its ratification on the other 26 EU states, but he has told supporters that he will never sign, the Times has learned. Asked during a walkabout on Sunday not to put his name to the treaty, Mr. Klaus replied, "Don't worry, I won't." After a crisis cabinet meeting yesterday, Jan Fischer, the Czech prime minister, avoided a direct confrontation with Mr. Klaus, bowing to his demand to reopen negotiations with the EU on an 11th-hour opt-out. However, he called on the unpredictable president to guarantee his signature if EU leaders agreed to his condition and if the Czech Constitutional Court raised no new objections. Mr. Klaus is demanding an opt-out for the Czech Republic that would prevent German families expelled after the Second World War from lodging property claims at the European Court of Justice. He raised the stake on Friday, putting a dampener on EU celebrations over the Irish referendum decision to back the treaty. And the president argued that the charter could whip up an avalanche of property claims from German families expelled from Czech territory after the war. Mr. Fischer's refusal to face down his president now throws the problem back to EU leaders at their summit in Brussels, October 29th to 30th, when they had hoped to celebrate the completion of the treaty. They had also hoped to appoint the EU president and foreign minister roles created by the treaty, but will now have to be content with a discussion about candidates, including Tony Blair. When the treaty has been passed by both House and Czech Parliament, by the prime minister, acting in a caretaker role after the collapse of Mayork's Topolánek government in May, ruled out any attempt to bypass the president. He said, "I would not like to talk about the constitutional crisis," Mr. Fischer told the Times. "The government is in a position to negotiate extra conditions revealed by our head of state, and we are ready to go to the European Council and put it on the table." Hinting at a breakdown in relations between himself and President Klaus, he added, "The government would like to have clear and sound guarantees from the side of the head of state that this actually the last step for his side and no other additional conditions will be added." Mr. Fischer, who will be in Brussels for talks today, said he hoped that the treaty would still be conducted by the end of the year. The lack of agreement from Mr. Klaus will infuriate other EU members, particularly France and Germany, which are pushing hard to wrap up the Lisbon Treaty.
Hmm.
I wish I should know more about this, you know, but it's really quite frightening what's happening over there. And all these countries that are virtually giving up their sovereignty to a European Union. And
the bloodless coup.
Yeah, and why, I don't know. I do not know. Very, very interesting.
Well, who knows whether they did this. Elections could have been fraudulent.
Yeah, more likely. Turkey. Our police called in as the rally against IMF and World Bank turns violent. Turkey protests. Nicolas Sarkozy, Banana Republic. Sarkozy got a French, got a gay minister.
Huh.
You know, French don't like that, I guess. Okay. That's about it on that front. Forgot about that Goldman issue.
Go ahead, take it. Thank you, folks. We just had to take that call. And we already read well, let's see if we can get to this Goldman Sachs again. We have this article, and just, we can tell people what it says when we go to it, what happened.
Well, I can't because there's a virus there.
Just leave it right there and says, it's mail online. Don't do anything. J.P. Goldman staff in line for bumper bonuses after investment bank posts blow-away profits of 2.25, don't do anything, billion pounds, because U.S. investment bank J.P. Morgan is set, don't, is okay, staff with huge bonuses after it announced blow-away profits for the last quarter of the year. The bank posted profits of $3.6 billion, putting its employees, of course, for pay and bonus packages averaging about £300,000 this year. The profits were much stronger than expected, with the bank's 4,000 London bank-based employees leading its recovery from the depths of financial crises. So far this year, J.P. Morgan's investment banking staff had generated profits of almost $5 billion. The generous payouts will come as a shock to those who thought that the credit crunch had put paid to the era of bumper city bonuses.
Citibank Goldman Sachs is expected to confirm tomorrow that bonuses will smash all records in 2009, just a year after the government rescued the financial system from oblivion. Why don't they freaking pay us back?
Yeah.
Okay, and the Wall Street giant is on course to lavish £14 billion on pay and bonuses on staff this year following a surge in profits between July and September. Yeah, because we bought off all their,
bad debt.
And that's
our money, that's all.
That's it. And Goldman's 5,500 UK workers are now set to pocket an average of almost £500,000 each for this year, the highest rewards in the firm's 140-year history.
Oh,
who the hell is paying them?
We are.
Yeah.
We're paying the British, and we're paying everybody.
No. That's unbelievable. Age is just
more rewards for the super rich.
Yeah. These two of the London-based Goldman Sachs executives in line for bumper bonuses, aged 43 and known to his friends as Witty, Michael Sherwood has already amassed a fortune of $225 million.
Pounds.
Or pounds. Okay. Such huge wealth built upon over 23 years with Goldman Sachs will just with just 1 month away working for a rival means that he can indulge his passion for football a little more than he's an average fan. A few years ago he spent £400,000 on a 1.6%
stake in his favorite
club. Tottenham Hotspur, which is a football club. Anyway, and there's one other guy here, Peter Sutherland, a non-executive.
He was a non-executive director on the board of the Royal Bank of Scotland, allowed Sir Fred
Goodwin
to the brink of collapse, costing British taxpayers a king's ransom. Some critics suggest the board's failure to take action showed its members were not doing their job. But Irishman Sutherland, 63, chairman of Goldman Sachs International, continues to enjoy a high reputation. Last year he was honored by the Pope, probably he has a stake in it, to whom he has given financial advice
there
when he was made a knight commander of the Order of Gregory on top of his honorary British knighthood. Described as a larger-than-life character, he insists that his reported £150 million fortune is not an important part of his life. After the education at the Jesuit Gonzaga College and University College in his native Dublin, then Barrister Sutherland became Ireland's youngest ever Attorney General at just 35. He went on to be a Eurocrat acting as competition commissioner in Brussels for 4 years before entering banking in 1993. He and his Spanish wife, Maria, have two sons and a daughter. Sutherland acts chairman of BP as well as Goldman Sachs.
British Petroleum and Goldman Sachs.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this guy is an Illuminati?
Yeah.
I think so. Do you think he's on the fast track to world domination? Probably. All right. These guys are the pigs of oil, the pigs of the world, just the pigs of the world. And let's go from there. And let's get some poetry into our life. Let's kind of forget these horrible people. What do you think, Lina?
Go right ahead. Turn it on.
Yeah. Terrible, huh? just terrible. But anyway, we are the world, so somebody said.
Mm. Huh. Go right ahead, play that, and it's an interview from last night.
Yeah, with George Krauss and Meredith Treed and a couple of poets. Yeah, pretty good. And we will take it away here.
We have two poets in one book and one poet in another. Let me talk a little bit about this first book, Desire Pass. This has poems by, I have the telephone number? Uncommon Accord. Okay. This is poems by George Krauss, Marcia Arida, Pat Landreth, Pat Landreth Keller, actually, and Michelle Carmen.
All right, here. we got three poets tonight. We got George Krauss, we have Michelle Carmen, and we have Martha Tweed.
And Martha is in Tweed. She's in the Desire Path. But in this book,
right,
we have two. George Krauss, he holds a PhD in Hispanic and Luso-Brazilian literatures and languages from the Graduate Center, City University of New York. He has worked as a translator and a scholar. His most recent scholarly work presented at an annual meeting of the Renaissance Society of America. Krauss currently divides his time between Rio de Janeiro and Tarrytown, New York, where he continues to write prose and poetry. Michelle Carmen's poems have appeared in Rattapalex, The Same, and Lumina, and other journals. She was a finalist for the 2007 Codhill Press Poetry Chapbook Award. She holds a BA from Columbia University and MFA from Sarah Lawrence College. Carmen has taught poetry at Sing Sing Prison. And in programs sponsored by poets and writers in New York City, she teaches writing at Fit Sunny in Manhattan. And that's in the book called An Uncommon Accord. And there are other authors in here as well. It's a nice little book, put together very nicely. It has an interesting cover. I like the cover. The cover has little bundles of sticks, and they're wrapped with yarn. It's just very interesting. And here's some of the things that it says on the back. What a good idea, gather chapbook-sized collection and print them together as one book. Four books for the price of one. There is, and someone else says, there is just enough room to give the reader an idea of each poet's range and sensibility, while at the same time allowing for more than one sensibility to be appreciated in a single volume. And this is put out by the Toad Lily Press in Chappaqua, New York. And the other book, Desire's Path, has a collection of one, two, three, four poets. And the one that we're going to feature tonight is Meredith Treaty. I'm not sure how she pronounces her name. But she lives in Sleepy Hollow, New York, where she and her husband are partners in a management consulting firm. She has been awarded residencies from RAGDL, the Constance Salt and Stahl Foundation for the Arts, the Virginia Center for Creative Arts in Virginia in France, and, oops, I just heard from Leo she can't be on, but she's in the book Desire Pass, and that's a pretty good book.
Okay, so, she will be on. Desire Pass will be on. The other one, Carmen.
Oh, Meredith Treaty will be on from...
Meredith Treaty will be, but Michelle Carmen won't be.
Oh, okay. Right. Well, so, let me just finish reading about...
We have them on the line.
Oh, good.
So, good afternoon, good evening there, George and Meredith.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you? We just introduced you, read your bios, and I'm Lila. Lila is my co-host.
Hi, how are you? Welcome to the L.A. Steel Show.
Thanks, Lila.
Thank you.
I just realized that one of our poets won't be with us tonight.
Right.
That's too bad.
But
we're glad to have the two of you.
Yeah, I thought we would have... how long... Now, you have five books out, I believe... when did you start this company, in 2000?
The Press, Toad Lily Press, was founded in 2005.
Okay.
And
and it was founded specifically to publish the four books in Desire Path, the first book. It came out of a writing group that I was in, and we wanted to sort of celebrate what we had been doing. We've been writing together for about 10 years.
Oh, wow. How did you all get together originally?
A couple of us had degrees. Some programs at Sarah Lawrence College. I have my master's in fine arts from there. One of the other co-founding publishers, Jennifer Wallace, has her MFA from Sarah Lawrence. And two other people had taken some writing classes together with Jean Valentine during their summer program.
All right. So it's interesting that you got this together and began it. But tell me, George. Now you've had a long history in academics and so on. You have a PhD. How long have you been writing?
I've been writing, quite frankly, ever since I can remember. For the last 30 or 40 years, I've been writing either prose or poetry. Of course, I took some time out, about 4 or 5 years, to write the famous doctoral dissertation. But since that time, I've been basically for the past 5 years or so writing poetry.
Oh, okay. So, I was admiring a couple of your poems here. I particularly like this, The Passengers. That was unique. That caught me. I said The Passengers, the poem, your poem, The Passengers.
Yes.
In the Uncommon Accord. I said I enjoyed that poem. It was rather dark, but I mean I was impressed by it. And I was wondering if you might be willing to read that poem to our audience.
Well, of course.
And
of course I will. I'm glad that you enjoy that poem.
I was kind of captivated by it, and I thought it was a very, very vivid image of what that was all about. So go ahead, please.
Okay. So let me read it.
Thank you.
Here it is. Passengers. The wind has left them here, silent as fresh Jama tracks on the white dusty road. So peaceful they seem asleep, without blood or bent bone. Their red express bus below lies crushed among the black rocks of a shallow stream that mirrors some white clouds and glitter of glass strewn down the slope. Now they no longer move, nor speak enigmatically in dialect, nor chatter busy as leaves when the wind strolls in a strand of eucalyptus trees. The air is pale, without assurance of garlic or the dark smells of soils black under fingernails. The wind stoops and tugs a loose lapel, pulls a hem, and then follows the white road down to a yellow field where someone with a reed flute walks among hollow stalks of corn.
Yeah, was this something you witnessed, or was this something you read about, or
what was your inspiration?
Yeah, what did you see this, firsthand, or what?
Inspiration was probably driving along a mountain road to a place called Chuquisaca in Bolivia and coming upon the aftermath of a bus crash. And so it's basically a real event, if you will, that I basically turned into a poem.
No, it was. I was impressed by it. I liked how you caught it and caught the image.
Of course, years later, I reimagined it. I didn't pull out my pencil and notebook at the time and write the poem. It took probably 10 years to work its way through the various orders and labyrinths of myself, if you will, and it finally came out one day when I flashed back upon that scene, and that's when I started writing it.
What caught me about that particular poem, though, was how you expressed it in the almost journalistically, but at the same time you caught the essence of it, the essence of death and the indifference of death, you know, the indifference of nature, the indifference of the world toward this incident, you know, where these people were just laying there dead and there was nobody around, you know, and it was, I don't know. I enjoyed the poem. You captured whatever the essence was of that moment, and I
and you got it.
I think you got it.
And it must be a fairly decent poem.
I felt it was. I you know, it grabbed me. And
that's good, because the poem also grabbed me. Actually, the poem helped me write it.
Well, sometimes I guess it's that way.
The good
when
one.
Something
the good
has
good
to come
poetry.
Out of you.
Good poetry is like that very much. And there was another one that...
Well, you're looking for the other one. I like Ladies Who Lunch.
Can I read all of that on the air, Lila?
Yes, go right ahead.
No, Lila, there's...
you have... It has the F word,
yeah,
that's all.
Just leave that word out, and you can do the rest.
Well, I can try that. All right. Ladies Who Lunch. Four businesswomen of a certain age in serious suits networking. A top-hand author, speaker, corporate advisor whispers, "Let's discuss the F word. I think, how quaint." The others quickly confess to their studly mate's need for nightly sex. My F must stand for fatigue. But lip ain't the word she's avoiding. It's 50, which I, again unique, admit to having been. My never-aging peers move on from facelift or not, through skin peelings and fat sucking to the M word she hesitates to say, menopause, which no one but me seems to think she's really having, thanks to various much-debated forms as to source, not need, of estrogen. I say I'll take hot flashes. I did my drugs in the 60s, mineral waters and decaf downed, a flurry of we must do this again, out into late afternoon, hurrying to get back to where we were.
Well, I think you captured that. And I think to appreciate it, you have to be a certain age.
Yeah, well, that's sort of what it's about. It's the baby boomers on our way well past the blooming years and being in denial about where we are.
Yeah, and you got it. That's so true. I got such a chuckle when I read it. I thought, this is great. Now, have you been writing poetry your whole life, or was this something that came to you later in your life?
I wrote poetry when I was young, in high school and college, and married fairly young, and then I didn't write for years, and I started writing again now. Maybe about 20 years ago, just doing it more and more until I ended up going back to school. I like going to school now that I'm a grown-up, so I did that at Sarah Lawrence, and I write pretty consistently when I can. I go to a lot of residencies. I heard you read that on the introduction. I'm leaving. I'm going to have another one coming up at Ragdale in Lake Forest. And
good.
That's a real opportunity to work, because I am sometimes a businesswoman of a certain age in a serious suit networking, and that doesn't give much time for writing.
Was there an event that brought the muse back to you?
I think it's just time to sit down and do it. You know, I would occasionally jot off a poem, but I think that, you know, like any other art, it needs constant practice. It's like you couldn't, you know, Van Cliburn sat in front of the piano for hours, and I think writers need to just have the time to sit and write. And when I was raising a family and working, I didn't have that time. And, you know, then as my responsibilities changed, I was able to make the time, that is.
Okay.
Well, that's wonderful. You've done a great job.
We'll ask you, there's a couple more that I'd like to mention as the, George, the magician. I enjoyed the magician.
So would you like to hear the magician?
I'd like you to read that to the
audience. Okay. The magician. He plucks silver coins from her eyes, pulls skeins of silk scarves from her sleeves, and from her mouth he draws a word. Hands, certain of scissors, along seams of air he cuts patterns and links generations of paper dolls. They dance in long accordion rolls, then meet the winds he summons with fingers precise as scalpels. Paper dolls scatter like snowflakes. His touch is cold. The wound in her side aches. Beyond him, she sees the mountains of his heart.
I was a bit confused. It was nice. The words flowed nicely, the imagery was. but I was a little confused at the last line, the second to last line, and his touch is cold, but the wound in her side aches, and beyond him,
you're having a little delay here.
Sorry. What I was saying is that I was a little confused about the last line of that last couple, the last stanza of that poem.
Uh-huh.
And I was curious if that was from something that you you had seen, or something you had somebody you knew, or what was the wound in her side? Well, what was that image? What did that represent?
Well, the wound in her side is aching. Obviously, the magician is a mysterious figure in this. He's larger than a single magician. As a matter of fact, he is probably standing before her as the world would stand before her. And he's a very, very commanding figure. And this could, of course, also have a lot to do with birth. It could have a lot to do with looking into the emptiness that awaits us. She looks beyond him and sees the mountains of his heart. We're talking here about the greatness of being and the great mystery that it is. So basically, that's the way I envision this.
I was wondering that, but I also wondered if there was a Christ image involved there, or an image of...
a Christ image?
But in a cloaked in femininity.
If you find one in there, I'll be very happy for you to point it out to me.
Well, only that in his touch is cold, and the wound in her side aches.
Okay.
But beyond him, she sees the mountains of his heart. So in other words, I don't know. This is what I was reading into it.
I think that's a good reading, Leo.
It enhances the line, doesn't it? but I mean, I can see it in a feminine. Description of Christhood,
huh?
Okay, of a Christ figure, and beyond the mountains, the essence of humanity, the essence of the future, the essence of heaven, or the essence of a God, God of a Father, God, kind of like a further and beyond. It was good. It was a magical poem, I thought.
That's good, because the poem is working for both of us.
I said maybe this is a far stretch, but I don't know. This is what I read in it. It had a much deeper meaning to me on this.
And one of the things that we talk about with poetry, of course, is that even more than reading a novel, is that what the reader brings to the poem is often more and or different than what the writer does. I mean, we talk sometimes about, we were having a conversation just before you called about sometimes it feels like you're channeling a poem, and I'm not getting new agey far from it, but it's just that you don't always know where images come from. They're just something that you hear and that develop on the page.
excuse me, but what grabbed me too is the magician is the first, the first card of the tarot, of the higher arcana, and, that's why I was surprised. It worked in a lot of different ways for a very short poem, and I felt it had a number of a lot of depth to it. And I appreciate that, George. Appreciate the whatever it was that channeled that one to you.
Well, and I also enjoyed your second poem in this book, The Hunger, having been a newlywed. And new to the kitchen, I enjoyed that very much. Do you want to read that one?
Sure, I'd love to. Obviously, when somebody who hasn't seen this on the page yet, part of my background is Irish, and at one point I was married to someone who was French, and the poem revolves around those differences. The hunger. Newly wed and new to the kitchen, I make potatoes every night. Mashed, boiled, skin on or off, fried or roasted. No potato rotted in my cupboard. I scrubbed wherever dirt might lurk. I'd learned how potato clumps in their lazy beds blackened, starving a million, sending the lucky to famine ships, hatches battened between decks of the dying. My husband loved to mock the Irish of me. The seven-course dinner of six-pack and a potato. He'd pretend to pull a tail dauphine, but lived for instant quick-cooked flakes. He tried out new beds and pronounced mine cold. I burned rice, made glutinous noodles, In the bad years, landlords exported food while tenants starved. The righteous blamed the starving for the blight. Some say we're a feckless race. Some confuse person with potato.
A little Irish history there too, Meredith. That was very good. A lot said in a few words.
Thank you. It's one of those I write about this person with some, or wrote about him with some frequency. It was sort of in the don't get mad, get even, so put it out on the page.
It works.
Well, that's very therapeutic.
I don't know if it's therapeutic, but it brings out a just sort of a comforting mean streak that needs to come out.
Well, that's kind of a harmless way, and other people get to enjoy it as well.
Right. I want to get back to George's, one more that he wrote that this one I enjoyed as well. It was called The Survivor. And this had an interesting tone and rhythm to it, a meter that I wish you could read to to the audience.
Okay. The survivor. Breaking upon the rocks, the boat slowly sank, although Map's End was just in sight. For weeks, waves bargained with rocks, and snails argued in whispers among dying weeds, murdered by desperate currents running ahead of the sea's old pull. Quixotic harmonies assembled along quick surfaces of silver water. A lone survivor wandered from the wreck late on the second day, mumbling in six languages. He gathered firewood and carved inscriptions on a tree before he died. During the next decade, a row of trees, against fierce winds and angry seas, moved 1 inch toward the shore to recover the promise of another island.
I enjoyed this. I could see it. But what's more, especially in the first stanza, I noticed a rolling of meter, kind of almost a wave-like, breaking upon the rocks, the boat slowly sank, you know. And although Map's End was just in sight, and it's just kind of like, you know, you had that rolling effect of waves, but also the interesting. What inspired this in you, George? What inspired this poem?
What inspired this poem? That's a very good question. Probably just thinking about, again, I seem to be up against an infinite world, if you will, and an undefined world, and this keeps basically running through my mind, if you will, and sometimes when it becomes clear, I can see the... Oops. Can you hear me, Leo?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead. We can hear you.
I can basically envision these kinds of situations and these kinds of scenes, and this was just one of these visions that I had, basically.
Now, during the next decade...
Ivor, yeah. Mumbling in various languages, of course. He's gathering wood. And to me, it's very, very concrete. What else would he be doing, mumbling in six languages and gathering wood? And, of course, he carves inscriptions on a tree. And then, of course, he expires. And then what really happens is that the next decade, in a row of trees against these fierce winds and angry seas, moves an inch toward the shore. And, basically, they it does recover the promise of another island. It's a very concrete kind of poem, and it also tells me, anyway, or at least the poem now is telling me, about the mysterious way that people venture forth.
What caught me about it was the essence of karma, the essence of reincarnation, the essence of eternity. Really, you had the eternal struggle here of life and death and nature and everything all in one. And I think you caught it very well in that poem.
Oh, I do. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm glad that you're reading it in a sense that basically can help me understand it even better. Good. That's a good reading.
I've written poetry for damn near 50 years, so it's like, I know, and I've read it and studied it, and I appreciate it very much, and I know how many good poems are really just come, you know, they come to you, and this one had its own voice.
Well, thank you.
Now, Meredith, you're in a writers group. How do you support each other in your group of women poets?
Well, we try to meet once every 6 weeks or so. There are a few of us that will meet and share a new poem that we're working on. And then some of us from that group meet with a few other women, and we meet to discuss other people's poetry. So we'll pick when C.D. Wright's latest book came out, we all read it, and then we met to talk about it, because we found that I need that kind of extension to hear other voices that are very different than what I write, and it is interesting to hear how my peers experience the same poems. So rather than just deal just with our own stuff, which can get to be a little incestuous, it's nice to expand the horizon and share other people's work.
Now, do you write every day? Or how does that work for you?
No, I don't. I'm a management consultant in my paid life. Mm-hmm. I'm also managing Toad Lily Press, so my days just don't work that way. But I do write extensively. The residency that I'm going to be going to, I'll write every day for 4 weeks, and then I'll just have a lot of stuff, and I can come home and work on editing it and putting it together.
Okay, so everyone does it a little differently. It sounds like you have that you're very busy in your life with the press and with managed consulting, but you've also managed your life in such a way that you can be creative too and really immerse yourself in the art
that you love. Really important for me. I mean, I find that my husband's not here right now to attest to this, but if I don't write, I get really cranky. It's just not good to be around me if I haven't been able to write for a while.
Now, what about you, George? How does that work for you?
Well, again, I write every day also,
mm-hmm.
or try to, and it has become a raison, if you will, and I really don't think I would want to live very long without being able to write. As a matter of fact, I'd be a very unhappy camper, I suppose, if I couldn't keep writing on whatever level that I write on. Sometimes I'm very, very fortunate to produce a survivor that other people read and find enjoyable. And for every survivor I manage to produce, there's all kinds of stillbirths and stuff that I don't even want to mention. But that's part of the the trade, if you will, or the craft, or the business. And it's a result of a continuous effort to keep writing and to keep exploring and to keep finding these places that in the mind and or in the body generate a poem.
Now, I have another question for you. Do either of you write at the computer, or do you keep a little journal, or how do you go about it?
I write everything longhand to start, often because I'm writing sporadically. I have a folder that I'll just throw notes into,
mm-hmm.
you know, as I walk almost every day, and the walking seems to generate words in my head, and I'll jot them down. If I can't get to them right away, then when I go on a residency or when I find days that I can write, I sit down. But my first drafts are always longhand,
mm-hmm.
and then I have to put it in the computer because I need to see what it looks like in print, and then as I'm working on it, I'm writing on my typed or computer-driven copy, and then print out again, and it's a back-and-forth process, depending on how long the poem takes to get to where I have to abandon it.
There were two poems by another poet that you had, Michelle Carmen.
Uh-huh.
I was hoping that she would read them to me, but I was wondering if you might read them for her.
I'd be more than happy to read them.
Well, actually, since they're written by a woman and they're rather it would be difficult for a man to read one of them. I was wondering if Arthur would be able to.
Sure.
Especially late August. I thought that was a very.
I love that poem. I would also add that.
Did you like that? Yeah, it was really unique. And I Met Two Horses, I thought, was another great one.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. I would read that too. I was Michael's editor on this book, as I was George's, so I love these poems. So this is Michael Carman's from An Uncommon Accord. Late August.
And I should mention that Michael is actually a woman.
Michael is a woman, yes, she is. She unfortunately had opera tickets tonight and couldn't be with us.
Oh, sorry.
Well, I hope she's enjoying the opera.
She is.
But I wish...
Late August.
Yeah, late August, yeah, that was a wonderful poem.
Suddenly you come upon me from behind where I stand watching two blue crabs in a bucket. The male scurries to cover the female with his body. She is mine, he says. His eyes bug out, rolling up to look at us, your breath on my hair, his claws a candelabra. Shall we dance? Mesmerized, she lies beneath him, your hand on my neck. Females, she and I, pretending we are not alive.
And that was an interesting poem. I really liked the idea of the crab looking up with bugged eyes.
Uh-huh.
It was beautiful. It was a beautiful image, and so clever.
Well, it's that back and forth between what the narrator is seeing and then the narrator experiencing the same thing. It's really a very chilling poem.
It is. It was brilliant, and please compliment her on that when I... I thought it was a brilliant poem. And the two horses I thought was very, very good as well.
And that was the first poem in the check.
The first poem.
That's right.
Yeah. I Met Two Horses. The North Sea has no direction here. It beats the rocks on all sides of this island. This far north, the sky is always gray. I've come to the end of the road. Beside me in a field, I see two horses shamble knee-deep in yellow grass. They look at me as if I were the wild one. One nuzzles the other's belly, then they move forward together. Eyes on me, they stop where the grass stops. This is all they can do. This is as far as they can come.
That was nice. It was nice. It was in the moment there.
Now, Michael also has a wonderful lyric sense. There's a...
Yeah, she does. No, she does, and she's got a wonderful sense of imagery, and I think she's a very, very good poet.
The simplicity of the apparent, you know, the diction and the vocabulary itself are simple on the surface, but she's saying so many things when she in these poems.
Yes, no, very, 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 very depth, great depth, and perhaps you could. One more that, yes, I know. Oh, just one second. This is WQQQ 103.3 FM in Sharon, Lakeville, and Millerton. You're listening to the L.A. Steel Show. And we are currently talking to several poets, George Krauss and Meredith Tried, and reading from one of several of their books, Uncommon Accord. And I believe that one is, what, Desire's Path?
Desire Path and Toad. Lily Press.
I'm totally Lily Press. And there's one, I'd like both of you to finish with a poem tonight, if you don't mind. And it's if there's any a particular one that is your favorite, George or, you know, either of you, if there's either of you have a favorite, I'd like you to read it.
Do you want me to read one of my favorite poems?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. One of my favorites in this, in Uncommon Accord, and Uncommon Accord is the last one of my chapbook rendition. It's upon reading a poem by Alberto Cairo. And Alberto Cairo is one of the heteronyms of a Portuguese poet, Fernando Pessoa. Basically, he invented a series of other poets, if you will. Some say he invented up to 20 poets. Three we know very well because he published these three books of three different poets. Each of these poets, of course, writing a different way. Alberto Alberto Cairo happens to be one of these poets. And so basically I am writing a poem about reading a poem by Alberto Cairo. And Cairo is a figment of Pessoa's imagination. So I don't exactly know where that puts me. But anyway, this is a poem. Actually, it puts me into the poem.
There you go.
Upon reading a poem by Alberto Cairo, I say to the plant, you're only a plant. I believe my body's more than a thing. I say to the stone, you're only a stone. Dumb I am to real things I face alone. Blind to ironies different winds bring. I say to the plant, you're only a plant. What more can I say to a stone or a plant? And if I listen, would I hear them sing? I say to the stone, you're only a stone. Aiming gives me what now I think I own. And while I doubt what I'm embodying, I say to the plant, you're only a plant. Senses transfer notions beyond recant, doomed to earth's continual wandering. I say to the stone, you're only a stone. At last I must accept what I can't grant, hiding now behind a voice, pandering. I say to the stone, you're only a stone. I say to the plant, you're only a plant.
There you go. Yeah, and very good, George. Enjoy yourself. And Meredith, would you like to...
What I'd like to do, if it's okay with you, since I'm also the editor-publisher of Tovoli, I'd like to read a poem of somebody else's.
Okay.
In our third book, Edge by Edge, we had a poet. We got a Pulitzer, a pushcart prize. And a pushcart, as you know, is a very big deal for a small literary press. And to have it for our third collection was pretty amazing. It's a beautiful poem called Door Song by Heidi Hart.
All right.
Okay, and I'd like to read that. I mean, we were just delighted. It's one of the best things that can happen to a writer of poetry is to actually win a pushcart for us as such a young press. So here's Door Song by Heidi Hart. Door Song. There are the doors in and out of the world, the white bed, the prison gate, the still pool deeper than it looks, the heart valve open or shut, the mine shaft, the stone rolled from the tomb. There are the doors of the body, the mouth that accepts the drink at last, the womb that lets in and lets out, the eyelid that lifts in recognition. There are the doors you see with an inner eye, the mold.
We'll say, turn the tape around.
We only have like a couple more minutes. What I wanted to ask you is if people at home wanted to get your books, how could they go about doing that?
Yeah.
We have a website, and it's tovolipress.com. It's TovolipressS.com. All five books are for sale on the website. There's a PayPal thing that you can click and take care of.
Okay.
And
also, what people might want to do is you can also hear our poets each read a poem on the website. That's kind of fun, too. So you could hear, I don't remember which ones from some of these people, but like you could hear one of Michael reading a poem on the website, too.
Oh, good.
Lila picked a poem out earlier tonight that, what?
We've already read it.
No, you didn't read that one. That was the one by one of the poets there that you really liked.
Oh.
About the draw.
Yeah, just a second.
Sorry. No, it's okay. There was a particular poem that Lila liked, that one of the poets, and I thought she might read it because it was very short, but it was very, she had a kind of a knack with it.
It knocked her out.
I forget who the poet was. It was a lady poet, but is that it?
That's food, clothing, and shelter. Yeah,
we're still here. Can you hear us?
Yeah.
I know it's on a speakerphone there, but okay. Well, I guess that's not going to happen. What's this one here? You had a dog-eared.
No, that's food, clothing, and shelter.
That was quite
a good one. I like that one.
Okay.
Did you like this? I thought this was a very good one. Addresses of all the houses I ever lived in are in a notebook in my night table drawer. Scraps of fabric rest there, remnants of dresses sewn for daughters years ago. Today, when no measure of nourishment could comfort me, I climbed inside the drawer. I thought that
What was the name of that one?
That is called Food, Clothing, and Shelter.
And that was by who?
By Myrna Goodman.
There you go.
It was very
good. Yeah, that's from the first book, from Desire Path.
Yes, that was quite a good one. That one kind of grabbed me.
Yeah. And these are nice anthologies because you picked out some very, very good poems. And
in January we're going to have a submission to pick the next book, which again will be 4 chapbooks in the perfect bound volume. So, and those submission guidelines are also on the website.
So if we have any aspiring poets in our audience, I hope they submit some poems, or just poet appreciators of poetry. I hope they buy some of your past chapbooks and support this artistic endeavor. It's very good.
And that's Toad Lily, Toadily Press.com. And please go visit it.
And we want to thank you very much for joining us tonight.
And George and Meredith, we want to thank you, and we'd love to, we hope you do well, and hope your book sells, and hope people get a little bit of appreciation for your work tonight.
Great, thank you so much. We also have a blog on the site, so if people have any comments or they want to say anything about what they heard tonight, that would be great, too.
Oh, good.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, too.
Thank you.
Thanks, right, George. Thanks.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. Good night.
And that was... George Krause and Meredith Treat.
Is it Treat or Treaty? Treat, I guess it was. Treat. She didn't correct us, so I guess that was right.
T-R-E-D-E, so I'm figuring...
Treat, maybe.
If there was a T-R-E-D-Y, it would be Treaty.
Oh, maybe. Yeah. Okay.
But anyway, that was our tribute to the poetic arts tonight.
They did a good job. Very nice work.
Talented artists. And,
and you have to remember, these are people that have whole other lives. One can't support oneself on one's poetry.
Okay.
I mean, they obviously are very committed people because Meredith is has published these chapbooks, plus she's a management consultant, and she writes when she goes to these workshops.
Yeah.
And
okay.
George writes every day.
So, yes, and so does Ellie Steele, so does, yes. Oh, by the way, you can see some of my work on, of course, on elliesteeleshow.org. Anyway, let's go to, we're going to give you a real poet here tonight, one of my favorite all-time poets, little Tom Waite. I guess
it's
been very different for you tonight.
Okay, good night. And, We wanted to want to thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed that kind of an excursion from our normal show and interview, but it's good to do that and break things up a little bit. Lyle and I both write poetry, and we've written many, many, many poems, and we are grateful to all those who do. So we want to thank you, and we wish you good night, and we hope that you'll join me tomorrow night for our show on spirituality, and we will try to complete the other essay by Paul Levy that we worked on we started reading last week. So I hope you enjoyed the show, and good night.